You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, September 17th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, I believe, from Glasgow, John Nichols of The Nation magazine on the vote for Scottish independence tomorrow. Also on the program today, Luke Herrine from the Rolling Jubilee of Stripe Debt. They're now buying up student loans. Also on the program today, speaking of students, Los Angeles Schools Unified Police Department to give up their rocket launchers. Not from The Onion. More on the NSA's sending Israel the fruits of its spying on Americans. Also, John Brennan. Not going to say who spied on the Senate Intelligence Committee. We'll get to that story. The Obama administration sending more troops, this time to Africa, and this time to fight Ebola. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, just a reminder, this show exists only because of our member support. If you have the financial means, please become a member today. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. You think buying a new URL is free? No, we got to pay for that. So we need at least a couple of people to go through that to pay to justify the purchase of that new shiny URL. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. We rely on your memberships. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link. Go to MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. Bookmark it. Buy all your Amazon crap through there or just do a one-off. It doesn't matter. You will notice no difference. We get a kickback. Thus, MajorityReportKickback.com. Also, JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's a co-op, so it's owned by the employees. Fair trade, so everybody in their production line, their supply line, everybody gets a fair payment for their labor. And you get 10% off on great coffee. And you can buy the Majority Report blend. There's anybody who drinks coffee, if you buy your bags of coffee, whole bean or ground, I think they have both, and you're not buying it from Just Coffee, why? Look at yourself in the mirror. This is good coffee. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to John Nichols, who I believe is in Scotland. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, live from Glasgow, Scotland. John Nichols. John, are you in a pub reporting right now?
I should be. There's no question. Either I should be in a pub or doing the classic journalist trick of asking your cab driver a question. But in reality, I'm out on the street, and it is, you really should be here, man. You cannot believe it. There are thousands of people out campaigning on all sides, but especially the Yes campaigners. They're very, very intense on this Scottish referendum. And it is a referendum on independence. And I know that you and I have both seen a lot of circumstances where people are disengaged, where they're unexcited about politics, where they're trying to figure out if it has any meaning. But you put independence on the ballot, and you cannot believe how intense things get.
And the vote is tomorrow, is that right?
It is tomorrow. It's a very, very simple question. One question on the ballot: should Scotland become an independent country? And what's fascinating about it is that the level of intensity around this is like nothing I've ever seen. I've covered elections all over the world and certainly many, many times in the U.S. But what's happening here is that because it's such a critical question, because it's such a basic question, will Scotland govern its own affairs, they have achieved a 97% voter registration.
Wow.
They are expecting something in the range of 87% turnout tomorrow. And so the big problem they've got is they're not sure, even though the polls are open from 7 a.m. till 10 p.m. tomorrow, how long it will take to vote, because they figure there's going to be a lot of people.
Wow. All right. So for those people who, and I consider myself one of them, who do not follow British politics, I mean, just give us a sense of first, like, you know, what is behind this? Scotland has been part of Great Britain, I guess, now for 300 plus years. What is driving this independence movement now, as opposed to it in the past?
Well, I think I wrote for The Nation today that one of the undercovered issues in the state, you know, many people see this as simply nationalism. I think in reality, the biggest issue is austerity. The British government under David Cameron, but really going back before that, starting with Tony Blair, has practiced a lot of austerity. They've done cuts. They've reduced services. There's been a long-term, going back to Margaret Thatcher, assault on trade unions. And Scotland is simply not on board with that. The best way to understand it is that Scotland has not voted for the Conservative Party, the Tories, since 1955. And today there are 59 Scottish members of the British Parliament. Only one of them is a Conservative. So this is a region of the country, of the United Kingdom, that is simply to the left of the rest of the United Kingdom on a host of issues. And so what has forced this independence referendum at this point is a sense that Scotland, which has a good deal of its own wealth, it has oil resources, wind energy, some of the best tide energy, which is using the ocean, as well as a very strong university system, strong banks, etc., that Scotland could go it on its own better, be a high-tax, high-service country, more along the lines of the Scandinavian countries, and just kind of get out of the British system.
And so give me your sense. I mean, I've been back and forth on this. I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, reading sort of both sides of the argument, and before we get into sort of the implications, if it would have any implications for the U.S. or the EU and Europe generally. But give us, both sides of that, because my sense is, in the 2008 crisis, the Royal Bank of Scotland would have been in pretty big trouble if it didn't have the greater UK to bail it out. Is that accurate? I mean, what are the chances? What happens if the oil reserves Is it the North Sea? I mean, what if those dry up? I mean, these all seem to be the questions that, you know, people who want a no vote are suggesting.
Without a doubt. Look, I mean, one thing to understand right up front is that polling suggests this thing is just about even, but it's very, very close to a tie. And there's a very good chance that the no vote will prevail. Remember, declaring independence, literally breaking away from a country that you've been associated with for more than 300 years, that's a big deal. There's research on American history that suggests only about a third of Americans were strongly in favor of independence in 1776. And so, you know, the thing to understand is that any independence move is a big deal. And the debate here has been incredibly intense with all of the arguments you bring into play, that Scotland is a small region. It needs a bigger country to be associated with, that Scotland cannot rely simply on North Sea oil, that Scotland, you know, is not in a position overall economically to make this thing work. The supporters of the yes vote have countered very, very aggressively. And interestingly enough, they have the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, if not on their side, at least arguing that they make some very, very good points. And one of the things that we've seen in this era of globalization is that the notion that big countries actually are able to achieve a lot, aside from, you know, being a great place for banks to headquarter or for you know, corporations to move wherever the taxes are lowest. The interesting thing about what we've seen is that often in this globalizing era, small countries, which are very contiguous to one another, where the people know each other well, where the politics is at a more human level, have sometimes been able to survive better. Norway being a classic example, but not alone in that regard. And so what you really end up here is kind of a gut check. You can hear strong arguments on both sides, and you can hear progressives on both sides. I think it's clear. My gut is that the left in Scotland, certainly, you know, most of what I see, tends to be for an independence vote. But that's not overall. I mean, there are certainly progressives who say no. But there's a fascinating campaign here called the Radical Independence Campaign. In fact, I'm talking to you. Literally, they're out, you know, campaigning here today across the street from me. And they've had things like, it's a very young campaign. They've had flash mobs in places like Aberdeen where 1,000 people show up just for a, you know, 5-minute flash mob. And their basic message is a very interesting one. They take a lot of their messaging from the anti-globalization Seattle protest back in 1999 and what has come since then. Their slogan is, another Scotland is possible. And their argument is that Scotland, as a small independent country in the 21st century, could actually do very, very well. And so, you know, you really do get both sides here. And it's not so simple as a lot of our politics in America. It's much deeper. And I think that's why you have such a high level of participation, such a high level of interest, because people really have thought about this issue. I can't emphasize it to you, Sam. You could walk into, you know, any room, get on any bus, get in any cab, wherever, any place in Scotland, and you're going to hear a serious discussion about all the economic issues you've just brought up, as well as a host of democracy issues and austerity and everything else. So it's really an amazing small-D democratic experience just to be here.
So let's assume for a moment that it's a no vote. In terms of what we expect to change simply because of the vote, it seems that British politicians have basically said we will devolve, I guess, or we will provide more sort of sovereignty, or at least, I guess, home rule for the Scottish Parliament. What would that involve, and how much latitude do they have? Because is that not a function of just sort of how much money they get from England?
Well, okay, well, here's where it gets interesting. You know, Frederick Douglass famously said, power concedes nothing without a demand. The independence vote has been a demand, and the British allowed the vote, assuming that independence would lose. they started to get polls about a week and a half ago, some actually showing independents might win, at the very least showing it was very close to a tie. And so British politicians panicked at that point, and they came rushing in saying, look, you don't have to go independent. Vote no, and we'll still give you control over your own affairs. We got the message. You clearly are not, you know, on board with how we do things, so we're going to change a lot. Now, what that really means remains very, very unclear. They've got something called devolution max, or Devo max, and that means to give a lot more power to the Scottish Parliament. What that could mean is that the Scottish Parliament will get powers of taxation and spending that it does not currently have. Effectively, the Scottish Parliament could be, in an economic sense, pretty much in control of Scotland. And they would be able to spend a lot more on social services, for instance, than healthcare, education. What that means is that Scotland, via this revolution, even if they vote no, might end up with a circumstance where they can reject austerity, which is a real, is a powerful force in England. We shall see, though, whether that actually happens, because, of course, politicians often make promises when they're scared. Then you get the complexity of the implementation. And so one of the big debates here is, do you vote yes, go for full-scale independence with the risks and the uncertainty that is associated with it, or do you vote no and hope that the British politicians will, you know, give you more latitude over your own affairs?
And so, all right, so let's look at the sort of there's a lot more questions in the event that Scotland votes yes, right? I mean, because everything from what will their currency be? Will they join the EU? Are they part of NATO, I guess? Do they get rid of their Trident subs? I imagine they would. Give me a sense of what the understanding is of people who plan to vote yes on those questions.
Well, let me put it this way, Sam. If they vote yes, you should probably move here, because you would have more stories every day than you can imagine.
What's the internet? Internet connection like there? Because I'm shopping around for a new office.
It's really good, and you know, look, I'm talking to you on the phone from Glasgow, so check it out, baby. But what I can tell you is, if they go independent, it will be an incredibly dynamic moment, very tense, very uncertain. But here's the bottom line. Scotland is a wealthy country. It's not some impoverished region. They have a relatively high level of unemployment, product of deindustrialization, as much as anything. But it has a lot of resources. So there is it wouldn't be a case where they'd have no ability to function. What would happen, though, is a roughly year and a half negotiation with the British government. It would be, at times, I think, very intense. The Scots would make high demands. The British would, you know, try to, you know, claw back resources. And, you know, obviously it would be a bit of a fight. But here's why some people in Scotland are arguing that it would work. And that is that the international community doesn't want a big problem on the British Isles. The international community doesn't want Britain, which is obviously has this supposed special relationship with the U.S., to have a crisis on its hands. And so as a result, there will be, I think it's beyond debate, there will be a good measure of pressure on England and Scotland to work this out, to make an equitable relationship for both sides and ultimately to go their separate ways, but probably, Sam, not as separate as some might expect. There is a chance they would have a shared currency. There is a chance that they might reach some sort of defense agreement. There are all sorts of possibilities for relationships, much like countries in Europe have. And the final thing, though, you did mention Trident, which is the nuclear submarines. There's very little question that Trident would go. That has been a core pledge of Scottish political figures, not just in the Scottish National Party, which is the majority party in the Scottish Parliament, but also a lot of figures within the Labor Party, the Green Party, which is actually quite strong here. So, yeah, there would be big changes, and some of them would be very relevant to the United States. Obviously, moving nuclear weaponry out of Scotland is a big deal. But I can tell you, I am literally, as to tell you how popular getting rid of the nukes is, I am standing, you know, about 100 feet right now from a huge banner that says, "Make Trident history, vote yes."
Well, and so give us a sense what happens to the left in the rump UK, as they're calling it. What's left of what's left of, and yes, a lot would be left of the UK. But what happens to the left there? Because it seems that at least a large portion of the left's support in English politics or British politics has come from Scotland.
Without a doubt. In fact, many Labour Party leaders going back to the earliest days of the Labour Party, which is the traditional party of the left in England, although much more moderate in recent years. But many of their leaders came from Scotland. And certainly the core of their vote has come historically from Scotland, from Wales, and from the north of England. If there was an independence vote, if Scotland went out, Labour would lose, you know, a lot of members of Parliament. And so if you just look at it on the core numbers, obviously, you know, it looks very bad for at least the, you know, the equivalent of the Democratic Party, maybe a little bit to the left of the Democratic Party in England. But here's the thing to understand. This independence vote is such a big deal. It is literally the front page of every newspaper, not just in Scotland, but in England. It is the lead story on the news, not just in Scotland, but in England, as well as Wales and the rest of the region. And so as a result, what you have to assume is if Scotland were to vote for independence, everything would be on the table. You would have a very rapid restructuring of the politics. It is possible that David Cameron, the prime minister, would see an incredible shakeup within his own Conservative Party. And remember, he's facing pressure from the right, this party called the UK Independence Party, UKIP, which has done very, very well in recent elections. And so you might see a breakup of the Tory party. Also, you have in England itself, you traditionally have a larger vote for the left than for the right, but because they have a so-called first-past-the-post system, and because votes get divided between multiple parties, they have a not just a Labour Party but a Liberal Democratic Party, you end up in a situation where the Tories tend to rule but without majority vote. You might well see a lot of the factions of the center and center-left come together to shape a new politics. The bottom line is everyone I talk to, Brits and Scots, will tell you that if Scotland votes for independence, which, again, I want to emphasize is still an uncertainty, right, but if it were to vote for independence, that would shake up the politics, you know, from top to bottom. And so I think it's not wise to assume that the British left would collapse just because the Scots go. In fact, you might see a radical reshaping. And I want to emphasize one other thing. If Scotland goes, Wales is going to be in with demands in about 30 seconds. And also, the north of England, which has been incredibly undermined by deindustrialization, suffers from a lot of unemployment, a lot of poverty, their demands would get much louder. So the fact of the matter is Scottish independence probably wouldn't be the end of anything. It might be the beginning of a lot.
That's fascinating. And give us a sense of what role, some of the bigger political leaders, like a guy like Gordon Brown, for instance, mm-hmm. Former UK prime minister, who edited a book called The Red Paper that called basically for Scottish socialism in the 70s. I mean, where is a guy like that on this?
Very good question. Gordon Brown is the most effective campaigner for a no vote. Gordon Brown, the former Labour Party Prime Minister of Great Britain, still quite well regarded by a lot of Labour Party folks and frankly, reasonably well regarded here in Scotland. He has campaigned very strongly for a no vote and argued that Scotland can do better as part of the United Kingdom. And so far more effective, I want to emphasize, than David Cameron, the current prime minister, or even Ed Miliband, the leader of the current leader of the Labour Party. Gordon Brown has been, you know, very, very effective on the ground here. And one of the reasons that a no campaign has held its own, despite, you know, greater excitement on the streets, you see a lot more people out campaigning for a yes vote. But one of the reasons the no campaign has held its own is because there are reasonable people and well-regarded people who make a case that in a devolved Scotland, Scotland could kind of have the best of both worlds, be part of the United Kingdom, but still have, at least enough autonomy to go a different way. Obviously, they are challenged very aggressively by one of the most able politicians I've ever seen, Alex Salmond, who is the First Minister of Scotland. He's the leader of the Scottish Parliament. And he simply argues, look, after 300 years, you know, don't count on the Brits to give us anything. You know, they don't hate the Brits, but the reality is that, you know, the likelihood that all the promises of a campaign will be kept in a post-campaign era are shaky. And so you really have had this debate where able people pull on both sides. They pull very, very aggressively. And it ends up in a situation where people have to follow not just their head, but their heart. It is an emotional leap. It's one of the reasons why polling suggests that younger people, particularly people in their 20s and 30s, are the most enthusiastic about independence. And you certainly see it on the streets with everybody wearing their blue yes badges. But also, it's a fascinating thing. The other night I was at a huge rock concert where a lot of the biggest bands in Scotland were performing. It's called A Night for Scotland, and they were all performing in favor of a yes vote. So, you know, again, among those younger voters, at least a portion of the younger voters, there's certainly an enthusiasm. As you get older, you do see, you know, all those concerns and all the worries about, you know, whether it would work. And so it's one of those divides, again, heart and head, a very complex situation, and yet one ultimately where you really do see people. I mean, I can't emphasize to you, Sam, you know how politics works in the United States, how often, you know, just limp and uninspiring it can be. Here, I'm standing there literally, you can't get down the street because there are so many people out talking to one another and, you know, arguing, debating. It's a very vibrant situation.
That sounds like fun, frankly. Rock concerts. You got a really tough gig you pulled there, John, I got to say. But
it's brutal. It's brutal, my friend.
All right. So, lastly, like, okay, so from the United States, I mean, what are the biggest implications for us aside from giving me the idea that maybe there's a couple of states here that maybe we should be starting to contemplate something like this? I'm not exactly sure how we would divvy it up, but. I assume a no vote's not going to have the implications for the United States that a yes vote would. But would a yes vote aside from, you know, looking at this as it's fascinating what's going on there. I mean, what could be the real implications for the U.S.?
Well, that's a terrific question. First off, you should understand that U.S. politicians have been very much a part of this. Hillary Clinton came to Scotland, and in an interview with the BBC, she said she strongly urged a no vote. Barack Obama's been a little bit more cautious in that regard, but it certainly hinted that he'd like to see a no vote. So do understand that there are definitely signals from a lot of prominent American politicians that they don't like this idea. Also some members of Congress, certainly a lot of business people. By the same token, if there is a no vote, people should understand that things aren't going to be finished at that point. England is going to have to go through a lot of twists and turns to resolve the issues, to deal with the promises that were made. It is not beyond the realm of possibility that Trident could be shifted. That's a big issue for the U.S. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that Scotland could get a lot more authority over its own affairs, and that could have very, very significant implications for a lot of economic arrangements. So, I mean, this thing isn't done. for the U.S., even if there is a no vote. Now, if there's a yes vote, well, that's a very big deal, because in the relatively short term, the United States government would have to figure out how it would relate to the new country of Scotland, the new independent country of Scotland. And I want to emphasize, if that did happen, the United States would actually, I would presume, be quite gracious about it, develop a very quick, very functional relationship. And here's why. As I said earlier in the conversation, the U.S. and, frankly, a lot of international business interests don't want a crisis. They don't want some sort of huge struggle between Britain and Scotland. I mean, this is a world, as you, I'm sure the rest of your show today are illustrating, this is a world with a lot of chaos in it, a lot of challenges in Africa, a lot of challenges in the Middle East. I mean, really serious issues in play. And so my sense is that the U.S. reaction to a yes vote would be, okay, if that's what they've done, sort it out. You know, get it. Let's make sure that this thing works. And so I don't think there would be some sort of very negative or bombastic U.S. reaction to it. My sense is it would probably be one of acceptance. And remember that Alex Salmond, the other leaders of the Scottish independence movement, have all said they want to be friends with the U.S. They want to work with the U.S. So the implications are real. There are consequential issues on the table, but I wouldn't see much likelihood that Scotland ends up as some sort of problem for the United States. I think the only real issue is that I think if Scotland goes independent, it's going to cause an awfully lot of people to look at self-determination issues in a lot of different ways. That's certainly true all over Europe. It is also true in the United States. I don't think you're going to see states breaking off or anything like that. But what I do think is that you will see a lot more discussion about why the District of Columbia doesn't have, you know, full voting rights or full statehood. You may see more of a discussion about Puerto Rico and its status. The bottom line is that there's a great philosopher here in Scotland named Thomas Nairn, who's written many, many books on these issues. And what he argues is that the 21st century will be an era where human rights becomes increasingly associated with self-determination, i.e. having the ability to govern your own affairs. If he's right about that, Scottish independence, my sense is, could capture a lot of imaginations and cause people, you know, all over the world to think not necessarily about declaring independence or breaking away, but certainly about whether they have real control over their own affairs and whether different arrangements, be they federal or structural, however they're done, might give them a better say in their future.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, John Nichols from The Nation, is there anything that we've left on the table? I can only imagine what the next 24 hours are going to be like there. I imagine it's going to be pretty crazy.
Do you know the biggest issue is? Whether there can be bagpipers at the polls.
Oh,
some
really?
People have argued. Oh, yeah, it's a big deal. They have several thousand polling places across Scotland, every little remote place. They also have extended the voting age to 16-year-olds because it's their future is in play. And so you're going to have a lot of new voters. You're going to have crowds at the polls. Obviously, the Scottish independence folks are all excited about this, and they want to bring bagpipes. And there are election officers saying, well, that might just be a little bit too chaotic.
Is that considered too much undue influence or what?
I don't know. Well, if you start putting the blue paint on your face too, you know, it's like there's a lot that can go with this as regards Braveheart, things like that. But the bottom line is that it's that kind of thing. There's incredible enthusiasm. I saw a guy last night out with bagpipes that blew fire out of the top of them with his yes badge on.
Wow.
Late last night, there were big trucks rolling through the city of Edinburgh with huge vote yes banners and reggae music playing. You know, there's literature. They have a large Polish population. There's yes and no literature in Polish. And so all I can tell you is it's an incredibly vibrant political moment that I think has a lot less to do with traditional understandings of nationalism than it does with democracy and this notion of putting big issues on the table and letting people wrestle with them. I have to say, no matter whether it's a no vote or a yes vote, I have covered a lot of politics. I've rarely seen anything this vibrant.
Wow. John Nichols from The Nation magazine, thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Sam, it's been a great conversation, and I'm delighted that your listeners and you are interested in all this.
All right, have fun. I have a feeling you will. All right, thanks so much. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're staying in the free half because we're going to be talking to Luke Herron from the Strike Debts Rolling Jubilee. They have made a pretty big announcement of abolishment of nearly $4 million of student debt. It's a small dent with the $1.2 trillion, but we'll find out where they go next. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, I'd like to welcome to the program Luke Herron. He's a third-year student at NYU School of Law and a member of Strike Debt, also a Lederman Law and Economics Fellow. Welcome to the program, Luke.
Thanks, Sam. Happy to be here.
And I have to say, for the sake of my father, who I think always harbored a secret dream that I would have gone to NYU Law following him, that my father, I'm sure, is excited to hear from you.
I'm glad to make your father proud.
Yes. Well, there you go. I'm delivering some measure of pride here. Now, first off, tell us what, for those people who don't know, tell us what Strike Debt is, what the Rolling Jubilee is. I think most people who listen to this program know that this was a basically came out of committee work, Occupy Wall Street. We're now on the third anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. But specifically, what is Strike Debt and the Rolling Jubilee Project?
So Strike Debt, as you say, grew out of the Occupy movement, specifically the occupation in New York. As the occupation started to wind down, or maybe you might say as it was shut down, a number of activists got together and held assemblies in Washington Square Park and realized that debt was the tie that binds not only them, but a whole lot of America nowadays and the world. They formed the Occupy Student Debt Campaign because that was the sort of debt that most of them were struggling with the most. And then that eventually became Strike Debt. And once Strike Debt was formed, one of the first ideas that came out of the group was to initiate what we call now the Rolling Jubilee, which is to raise money and then to buy debt on the secondary market. And the secondary market, you can buy debt for literally pennies on the dollar, 3, 4, 5 cents on the dollar. And then whereas most people who enter this market buy this debt so that they can collect as much as they possibly can on it, the idea is that the Rolling Jubilee buys that debt and then abolishes it, completely forgives the obligation to repay.
So for people who don't, weren't aware that there's this sort of like secondary debt market, I mean, just walk us through that a little bit, because I don't think people realize you owe money to a hospital, say, and it's quite clear after a certain period of time that you can't pay. They basically auction off this obligation or note that they have from you. Different debt companies will come by and just say, like, all right, this guy owes, $100,000 because of a medical emergency. We'll buy it for X and we can hopefully collect Y. Is that basically how it works?
That is basically it. So for instance, this latest debt that we bought is from Everest College, which is a subset of this massive for-profit college network called Corinthian Colleges. And this was basically, unmet tuition bills that Corinthian immediately sold to debt buyers for about 3 cents on the dollar. So we paid a little less than 3 cents on the dollar for it. And so whereas normally a debt collector would buy that from Corinthian for 3 cents on the dollar, and then, anything more than 3 cents on the dollar is pure profit for them. So they just try to collect as much as possible. They'll tell the debtor, you owe the full amount, and they'll try to collect the full amount. But if the debtor negotiates down, they're happy to make anything more than 3 cents on the dollar.
And, just so people know, can I go out and if I owe this money, can I go out onto this market and buy my own debt?
If only that were the case. That's what corporations can do, but not individuals. This debt is sold in massive bundles, thousands, hundreds of thousands of debts debts from individual debtors are sold at the same time in sort of this anonymous package. And then what happens is the debt buyer or the source of the debt will, what they sell you is basically some names and addresses, sometimes some more information. And that's only then do you find out whose debt you have. And then if you're a debt collector, you find out their address and phone number and start hounding them nonstop.
And so, wait. So, when you guys went in, you raised what was it? How many millions, or how much money did you raise, and how much money did you discharge? How much debt did you essentially vaporize?
So, we have raised in total. We stopped taking donations at the end of last year, but up to that point, we raised about $700,000. Almost entirely from small donations. I mean, and we have the transparency up on our website. And so far we have, abolished, about $15 million of medical debt. And then with this debt by an additional $3.8 million of student debt. So that puts the grand total around $19 million. For this latest round of debt, we spent about $100,000. We spent $100,000 for $3.8 million of debt. That's about 2.7 cents on the dollar.
Wow. And so when you did this last round, you had the $100,000. You go into, I guess, it's specifically a student debt market. You didn't know. Did you know whose debt? You didn't know. I mean, it seems to me you didn't know whose debt you were buying. But did you know from whom the debt was incurred? In other words, did you know you were buying stuff from Everest College, or was how much do you know about what you're buying in that debt, I guess?
Right. So it actually varies greatly with the type of debt, with the amount of money that you're willing to spend, the amount of debt that you're getting. But in this case, we ended up the first institution we wanted to buy debt from was Sallie Mae. And I think maybe many of your listeners will be familiar with who Sallie Mae is. They do a lot of, and they've now spun off Navient, who does their basically student, public student loan debt collecting, but also private student loan debt collecting. And in fact, when we reached out to Sallie Mae, we actually ended up talking with somebody who was getting ready to, you know, was interested in selling this debt. I think a lot of people don't know that Sallie Mae sells debt on the secondary market. And then as soon as they found out that we weren't going to collect it, they clammed right up and were not interested. You know, it was an experience worth having just to hear Sallie Mae admit that it sells debt on the secondary market for again, pennies on the dollar.
It's also interesting because clearly they don't want it widely known that this debt is available so cheaply, right? I mean, but why is that? I mean, why do you think that is the case?
Well, that's a good. So it's important to distinguish here between what might be called public student loans, that is student loans issued by the government, and private student loans. And that's student loans issued by, you know, a bank or the college itself, in this case by Corinthian College itself or Everest College itself. But so public student loans aren't generally sold on the secondary market as much because the federal government has extraordinary powers to be able to collect that debt. And also, you know, previous to when Obama declared that there weren't going to be any privately issued public student loans, it used to be a much more confusing system. Now the government just issues the loans directly. The government guaranteed those loans. So there's very little reason for the government or for a collector for the government, say Sallie Mae, to sell public student loans in the secondary market because they have all of these extraordinary powers to collect as much as possible as they can on it. That doesn't mean that they're never sold in the secondary market. Sometimes if a debt is really hard to collect, and it just doesn't seem like the person is going to respond even to, you know, lawsuits and court proceedings, then it might be worth selling. But private student loans are different. They're much more like other consumer loans, like say credit card debt or you know, auto loans.
And those private student loans, can they be discharged in a bankruptcy as opposed to government sponsored student loans, or is it all student loans you can't escape in a bankruptcy?
That is a good question. I believe, unfortunately, I don't think I want to answer that question. I would have said that there's a difference, but I don't want to say that without double checking.
Well, then I want to note that for my father, that even though I'm not at NYU Law, I wouldn't have necessarily known that had I completed law school. So
that's right. Well, I'm in bankruptcy class this semester, so maybe I'll know by the end of the
All right. Well, my father also bankruptcy attorney. So
oh really? Okay.
Yes. So anticipate an invitation to dinner at my father's house. I probably won't be there, but with that question, it's rare that the government will put it on there because they have sort of extraordinary means in which to collect this debt. One of the stories I saw earlier this week was that there was a significant amount of student debt that was actually being they were garnishing the Social Security benefits.
Right.
Of both people who are eligible for retirement benefits and disability benefits, which is particularly egregious because if you're getting disability payments, it's because you can't work and obviously can't pay it. So is that the kind of debt that they sell?
I should point out that most, you know, for most sorts of debt, they're not allowed to collect on public benefits, on Social Security or unemployment. That's uncollectible for most sorts of debts, but the government can do what's called an administrative offset. So if you owe, you know, they can take it out of tax liability, they can take it out of Social Security benefits, they can take it out of a whole number of different. If the government, you know, provides you with money, they can take student loans out of that if they want to.
Well, of course, because why would you want to incentivize getting a more educated population?
Well, that's exactly what we're trying to highlight with this buy and with the formation of the debt collective, which is that the Department of Education is not oriented towards helping people get education in large part. The Department of Education is basically a debt collector for for-profit colleges and for other colleges. So, you know, the Department of Education here has substantial powers to forgive the debts of, let's just talk about the Corinthian students for a second. There's a number of ways that they could make things easier for these students and, in fact, completely forgive their obligation to pay that are written into student loan law. But the Department of Education is currently trying to basically sell as many Corinthian campuses to keep them open under another owner. I would ask whether that's because they stand to, you know, collect billions of dollars from these students.
Interesting. And so, I mean, getting back to, I may have interrupted you, but so when you when Rolling Jubilee purchases $100,000 for this to buy up this debt, do you know right. that it comes from Corinthian College or Everest College? Or
right.
do you, I mean, I assume you don't know, hey, it's Jim Peterson and Betty Thompson and so-and-so who owe this debt. But do you know who it was owed to?
Right. So when we're buying it, we did know that it was from Everest College, which I should be clear. Everest is, Corinthian College has a series of brands, and Everest is one of its brands. Corinthian is the biggest for-profit college company in the country, although it is currently on the verge of collapse. In part because of a massive number of lawsuits against it, including one by the CFPB filed yesterday. We knew that Corinthian was perhaps the most egregious actor in this market. We didn't know, as you say, the individual debtors until we bought the debt and got the information on these debtors.
So lastly, all right, so what happens? I went to Everest College, let's say, and with what happens with a lot of these for-profit colleges, I'm one of the people who dropped out. I still owe them whatever it is, $65,000 in debt $20,000 in debt, $15,000 in debt. Did I just get a letter this week that just said, hey, guess what? You don't owe any more money? It's gone?
That's right. So we sent out letters to all the students whose debt we forgave. Usually it's a matter of hundreds of dollars for most of these students, although that's a big deal for a lot of these students because the attendees of for-profit colleges tend to be low income to very low income. So yes, but we sent them a letter and they found out that a lot of them, of course, didn't believe it. But once they called us or emailed us, we gave them our contact information, and we told them what happened. A number of them have already spoken to the press about it, and even more students who have heard about this, who we've been in contact with, whose debt we weren't able to buy at Corinthian, are now banding together and organizing to resist the debt that has been imposed upon them by this predatory institution and by the Department of Education as a debt collector. So we don't see this as the end, by no means. You know, $3.8 million is a drop in the bucket compared to $1.2 trillion of student debt. What we see as the inevitable next step is for student debtors, not only of for-profit colleges, but in general, to band together and to demand that that public education is a public good, is right. free and accessible to all people who want it.
Great. That's great. And I can imagine, I mean, if I had gotten that letter, my first reaction would be, this is some type of advanced fee scam. This is coming from a prince, somewhere whose cousin left money in a bank or whatever it is. Have you had any like personal conversations? Like, were you on one of the receiving ends of one of these emails? Because I imagine these folks are just, it's got to be a huge, huge, just emotional relief to them.
Yeah, I personally haven't talked with any of the individual debtors, although some of them have other legal questions that we have put together a legal team to try to help people connect with. But I haven't, unfortunately, been able to talk with any of the individual debtors, although if your listeners are interested in hearing some of their stories, a couple of the news sources that have covered the debt buy already have put some of their stories in, have direct quotes, including NBC News and CNN Money.
And I imagine you'll have some of those at the websites. I got strikedebt.org, rollingjubilee.org, and debtcollective.org. We will put links to those at majority.fm. Luke Herron, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate your coming on and appreciate the work you've been doing.
Thank you, Sam, and thanks for covering this story.
All right, folks, that is our extra bonus free show today. Unbelievable.
Today was an inspiring show.
It was an inspiring show.
I feel very uplifted.
I do too, but I just feel like we give and we give and we give.
Jewish mother right there.
That's right.
It was great.
Actually, yes, there was a little bit of, yes.
There's a little bit of that. Scottish independence. Strike.
So, death. Folks.
We give and we give and we give.
While I may have disappointed my father that I did not go to NYU Law, and while I may have disappointed him when I dropped out of a BU Law, I hope that we have not disappointed you and you will become a member. The Majority Report. You can become a member today. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Become a member today. And with every new membership that we get in the next 48 hours, I will send an email to my dad saying, look at that, Dad. Somebody joined. How do you like them apples, buddy? He's gotten over it. He's gotten over it. It's only been now, it's only been about 22, 23 years, 24 years. He's just about gotten over it. And of course, you can support the show by using our Amazon link to buy your junk from Amazon. If you buy any junk from Amazon, go to majorityreportkickback.com. Also, justcoffee.coop. That's justcoffee.coop. They have a co-op instead of com because they're a co-op. And it's just coffee, even though it's also tea and chocolate. They should work on that. And use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And we get a little kickback from that. 646-257-3920 is the number. Tomorrow on the program, Chris Hayes to talk about his piece in The Nation magazine entitled The New Abolitionism, about climate change and to highlight the big People's Climate March in New York City taking place this Sunday. I'll be there. Let's head to the better half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920. You can IM me via the app at majorityapp.com. We got an iOS and Android app. It's free. Or you can IM me through any of the Majority Reporters, Majority FM on AIM, any of the legacy IMs they have of us. We'll be right back after this.